Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Derek Litvak and I'll be your host. Today we have the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Anne Twitty, author of Before Dred Scott, Slavery and Legal Culture in the American Confluence, 1787 to 1857, published by Cambridge University in 2016. Dr. Twitty is Associate Professor of History at the University of Mississippi. Before Dred Scott looks at numerous freedom suits filed in the St. Louis Circuit Court in order to examine the legal culture of slavery and freedom. In this area, known as the American Confluence, a unique legal culture developed, characterized by a sophisticated and widespread knowledge of formal law. From enslaved people to slaveholders, Dr. Twitty illustrates the many ways people in this area were deeply enmeshed in law. Dr. Twitty, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, so I guess to start everything off, can you tell our listeners how you became interested in this topic in the first place?
Sure. Well, I have to say, first of all, that I didn't go to graduate school thinking that I was going to be a scholar of slavery. I went to graduate school loving the 19th century, knowing that I wanted to work in the 19th century, but thinking that I was going to be a gender scholar. And so I went to Princeton to work with Christine Stansel. She's excellent, wonderful. And in my second year, I was in a class that she was teaching called Metropolitan History. And she knew that I had a deep interest in the Midwest. I am a native Midwesterner. In fact, I'm a native Missourian. And she'd recently come across a database that contained all of these freedom suits that were filed in St. Louis that had been made publicly available, digitized, and put on a website. And she said, hey, you know, I've heard about this project and I think you might be interested in it. And I started looking at the files that had been digitized and really just fell in love with them. And fell in love with them. Not only I was interested in law, although that wasn't a particular area that I necessarily thought that I would focus on. I fell in love with them because I thought that they were such an amazing resource for understanding the institution of slavery and for understanding enslaved people.
Wow, it's an interesting way of getting to things. I guess plenty of us in grad school kind of think that we're going into one thing and then end up doing something completely opposite, or so to speak.
Yeah, no, I think it you know, when you look back, I think over a career, it's amazing sort of all the twists and turns and the things that I think you couldn't have anticipated. I mean, I think, you know, often what historians tell their students when we're training folks is to be open-minded and to go sort of where the evidence takes them. And I think in this particular case, you know, it was an instance of sort of me maybe taking that particular set of advice that I found something that I just wanted to immerse myself in and wanted to continue thinking and learning more about. And so I think, you know, rather than being sort of dogmatic about this is who I am and this is my identity and this is what I work on, being a little bit more flexible or open certainly worked out for me.
Yep. Well, I can certainly appreciate that. You got a great book out of it. So so your book is called, you know, the second part of it is Slavery and Legal Culture in the American Confluence. So what exactly is the American Confluence?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it's not a term that's in regular circulation. I have to say that I owe a tremendous debt to Stephen Aaron, who wrote a book called The American Confluence several years before I did. So I borrowed this kind of concept. We define the term a little bit differently. But for me, the American confluence is defined by the meeting point of the three major American waterways. So the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, and the Ohio River. These kind of riverine highways that really define the center part of the North American continent. And importantly, in the period that I'm interested in, the late 18th century and the first half of the 19th century, this is a place where there are these important political boundaries that are marked off by these rivers, but people are transversing these regions, this center part of the continent. For me, the American confluence is made up of, the present day states of Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri. And by the mid part of the 19th century, three of these states will be considered free states. They are states that are carved out of the Northwest Territory, which is a piece of legislation that's passed while the Articles of Confederation are in force. This piece of legislation, the Northwest Ordinance, passed in 1787 and basically says that slavery will be prohibited in this Northwest Territory. Later on, these three states that I say make up a part of the American confluence north of the Ohio River, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, ultimately those three states will enter the Union as free states. They have constitutions that for the most part ban the institution of slavery. But then in addition, this region includes places like Kentucky and Missouri. Kentucky enters the Union in 1792 as a slave state. Slavery is authorized in that portion of the country. And then Missouri, of course, very famously enters the Union very contentiously in 1821, finally, after several years of disagreement, national controversy over whether or not slavery is going to be legally permitted in that particular state. So by the mid part of the 19th century, we think of these two groups of states, Kentucky and Missouri on the one hand, and Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois on the other hand, as contrarily slave and free. But at the very beginning part of my study, these lines aren't so neatly drawn. There are slaveholders and slaves in all parts of the American confluence. Slavery and indentured servitude, these two disparate forms of bound labor, are prevalent in both. And so I'm trying to make an argument that despite the fact that by the mid-19th century, we think of these two groups of states as diametrically opposed, that in an earlier period, that simply wasn't the case. And that in fact, they had a great deal in common with one another.
That's very interesting. I know for myself, I wasn't used to thinking about, these states in that kind of framework before reading this book. And I think one of the ways that you described it early on as the meeting places for all of these rivers is really interesting, considering the ways in which during this time period, especially before railroads become sort of ubiquitous across the United States, that waterways are kind of the way of traveling fast, of ways of getting your crop to market and all of these things. And so this is kind of a natural place where this unique culture, as you say in the book, is bound to happen almost.
Absolutely, right? The rivers in the late 18th century, first half of the 19th century, are really the highways of the nation. And that's true in a variety of other places outside of this particular region that I'm so interested in. I will say, I think one of the other difficulties is that this is, I would argue, an incredibly important part of the new nation. And yet we haven't really had a term to apply to this region of the country. Most of the terms that can be used often imply something a little bit different. So we haven't really had kind of a neat shorthand. So one of the things I think I was trying to do with the book is to put, kind of this idea of the American confluence region on the map, so to speak, right? To get people thinking about these five states. And I'm sure somebody else could argue that you could put one or two additional states in this particular region to get this kind of terminology in maybe more common usage, to get people thinking about this part of the country again.
Yeah, because I think most people, when they think of slavery, they usually think of, you know, the quote unquote free North and the slave South. And what your book is really doing is kind of throwing a wrench in that and saying, you know, there's this whole part off to the West that is much more ambiguous when you look at it. So how does slavery operate differently here? Why is the American confluence, you know, and make slavery kind of not as concrete as you might see in the East?
Well, a big part of it is the tremendous amount of mobility that people have throughout this region. This is a time period during which, you know, people aren't just moving to a particular location and staying put for the rest of their lives. They're constantly in search of better opportunities, of better places to grow crops, of better locations that won't flood quite as frequently. So people themselves are routinely moving across these political boundaries. And these political boundaries do have significance, right? It matters whether or not you're north of the Ohio River and on free soil in the Northwest Territory, or purportedly free soil on the Northwest Territory, or whether you're in Kentucky or Missouri Territory. So that's part of the explanation, the incredible mobility of people in the late 18th century and first part of the 19th century in this particular region. I think the other reason that slavery looks a little different maybe in the American confluence than it does in some other locations is that this part of the North American continent changes hands so frequently over the course of the late 18th century. You know, Missouri in particular goes from being a French possession to being a Spanish possession to being a French possession again. And finally, of course, it's purchased by the Americans in 1803. So that kind of juridical confusion and different types of legal orders and legal regimes, you know, setting up stakes in a particular region and then leaving and then creating kind of a vacuum for the next imperial power to seize the reins. That creates, I think, sort of a more complicated situation. You know, I think it's also important to note that despite this piece of legislation, the Northwest Ordinance, being adopted in 1787, saying there shouldn't really be slavery in this portion of the North American continent, the reality was that slavery had existed for centuries before the Northwest Ordinance is adopted. So, you know, the founders sitting on the Eastern Seaboard kind of make this proclamation, but reality defies it, or it is defied by reality, right? They're essentially trying to sort of project upon the Northwest Territory this free status that it doesn't already possess. There are already many French inhabitants who have held slaves for a long period of time. Some of the slaves that these native French speakers have been holding are Native American. Some of them are African and been imported to portions of the American confluence. So slavery is actively being practiced long before Americans get their mitts on this portion of the North American continent. And then there's, right, an attempt to sort of impose a free status on a part of the continent that had not historically been free.
And I think for me, thinking about it that way is so interesting, because people who are somewhat familiar with slavery and the kind of development it has in the country might be familiar with the ways in which Louisiana is somewhat different than the rest of the Deep South because of the way it would change hands between certain colonial powers. But we don't really think of the, you know, the old Northwest and the Midwest as being that in that kind of camp, but it is. And I find it really interesting the ways in which that deeply influences the development of American slavery.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, Louisiana has gotten a lot more attention in part because New Orleans becomes so influential early on. It's a lot more heavily populated from an earlier period. And Louisiana continues to have, for instance, a civil code that's influenced by French control of Louisiana for a long period of time. And they maintain a civil code for much of the 19th century. You don't get quite the same story a little bit further north in Missouri, but there are kind of echoes. There are, you know, and I don't think that it's necessarily a random coincidence that you find a tremendous number of these freedom suits in St. Louis. We think it's one of the largest collections of freedom suits in North America. And the other sort of city that has a tremendous number of freedom suits being produced is New Orleans. And I think there's a lot of reasons why this happens to be the case. And again, is related to not only the doctrine that is ultimately adopted by the respective state Supreme Courts in Missouri and Louisiana, but reflected by this riverine culture, this culture of mobility where people are constantly traveling, you know, up and down the Mississippi River, but also, you know, in Missouri, they're arriving in Missouri from the Ohio River. And so again, this kind of culture of mobility that is so present in Missouri, also present in New Orleans, and produces some tremendous similarities.
And so, speaking of the freedom suits that you look at in the book, how do enslaved people go about suing for their freedom? How you make the point that these people have a very deep knowledge of the law, and so how do they develop this?
Well, one of the arguments that that I think is something that became really important to me over the course of writing the book is thinking about the ways that marginalized people generally approach the law and the kind of proximity that people who, you know, otherwise don't have access to power, maybe relatively impoverished, are oppressed for a variety of other reasons, you know, related to race and gender, how in some ways they have even more of an incentive to learn the law and to understand sort of the finer points of the law than, you know, somebody who today we would consider to be distinctly middle class, right? And you know, if you are living truly sort of on the margins, you have a real vested interest in knowing what you can and can't get away with, what you can and can't be prosecuted for, what the letter of the law actually is. And you know, I think, you know, if you want to make a kind of contemporary analogy to it, you think about, you know, somebody who is really living paycheck to paycheck and they worry about making their rent payment every single month. You know, there's a real incentive for somebody like that to know exactly what eviction law is, when they can be evicted, how many days they can continue living in a place without having been able to make their rent, right? That's just kind of one example. And I think enslaved people, for many of the same reasons, because their entire existence is defined by the fact that they have this legal status as slaves, as, you know, in some places chattel slaves, in most places chattel slaves, in other cases as forms of real property that can't be moved. But regardless, they have this legal identity, and this legal identity is incredibly influential in shaping the courses of their lives. So they have, you know, every reason in the world to be as well versed as possible about what the law does and doesn't do, about, you know, the few instances in which the law might offer them some form of redress. And additionally, you know, you add to that the fact that slaveholders too have a vested interest in knowing what the letter of the law is, exactly what they can get away with, and the kind of you know, racist ideology that leads them to believe that Black people maybe can't understand the finer points of the law. So you get instances of slaveholders talking amongst themselves about how the law works, and slaves being privy to those conversations and picking up that information and then using it to achieve or accomplish their own goals. You get examples of enslaved people talking to one another. In fact, one of my favorite pieces of evidence doesn't actually come from a freedom suit itself. It comes from a newspaper article. And it's a newspaper article in which somebody is writing in to complain about how many freedom suits there are. And this particular correspondent to this antebellum newspaper describes how this legal information is transmitted from slave to slave. And it's basically an article that's describing a kind of grapevine telegraph, a process by which, you know, one enslaved person has some information and they tell everybody that they know, and those people tell some other people, and they use the information that they've gotten and they combine it with information that comes maybe from other sources. And collectively what they're doing is creating this information within a sort of broader sort of Black community, that those who are fortunate enough to have lived under circumstances that could form the basis for a freedom suit might be able to take advantage of the portion of the law that allows them to sue for their freedom if they can argue that they've been illegally enslaved.
And I think that's a really interesting way of putting it, that the people who are on the margins are, as you said, have such a vested interest in knowing what the law is around them and how they need to be able to take advantage of it if need be. And so going a little bit further into what you talk about, how do enslaved people bring these suits? Who are they seeking out to help them? What sort of lawyers are they talking to? Who's helping them?
Sure. I think this is a great question. It's a bit of a difficult question to provide concrete answers to because there are a variety of different paths that enslaved people can take to suing. Unlike all other forms of civil litigation, a freedom suit doesn't begin with a plea. Instead, a freedom suit begins with something called a petition. You begin by petitioning the court. And a petition to the court can begin either sort of on the slave's own behalf, the slave appears in the court, or I think more likely in the context of the St. Louis freedom suits, an enslaved individual has approached a justice of the peace, and that justice of the peace has written up a petition, and then that petition can be submitted to the court. In other cases, rather than approaching a justice of the peace, maybe you go ahead and consult an attorney from the get-go. Now, interestingly, the way that Missouri law is written, slaves aren't supposed to be responsible for identifying their own attorneys. The way that the law is written suggests that the court will appoint lawyers for individuals who are seeking redress through these freedom suit statutes, right? They will enter their petition to the court, and once that petition is granted, then the court will assign an attorney. But what you find when you actually take a closer look at the documents that make up these freedom suits is many of the petitions are in lawyers' handwriting. So we know that the lawyers had to be engaged before the court ever received or accepted those particular petitions. And that is evidence that these enslaved people are seeking out their own legal representation. They're not sitting back and waiting for the court to select someone for them. They're instead taking a proactive role in identifying somebody who they think is going to be a zealous advocate for them. And of course, then that raises all of these questions about how one figures out who's going to be a zealous advocate in prosecuting a freedom suit. You know, who's going to be a good attorney as opposed to, whoever it is who happens to be in the court that day, who the judge assigns to your case. You don't want to take those kinds of chances. You want to make sure that you've identified high quality representation. And there is quite a bit of evidence that a number of the freedom suit plaintiffs in St. Louis really do take this role upon themselves. But I do want to also stress that the lawyers who take up these cases, generally speaking, they are not abolitionists in the traditional sense of the word. They are not egalitarians. They don't seem to really be particularly active in anything that we would consider to be sort of an abolitionist network or society. They're not involved in sort of religious anti-slavery for the most part, although some of them are religious. A handful of them are involved in the American Colonization Society, which, you know, we might perhaps consider to be a sort of a more conservative form of anti-slavery, in many ways, a deeply racist form of anti-slavery, but a form of anti-slavery nevertheless. But that's about as radical, generally speaking, as these attorneys get. For the most part, these attorneys, I would argue, are taking on these cases because these enslaved plaintiffs represent good clients, paying clients. Again, the Missouri state statute suggests that these enslaved plaintiffs aren't supposed to be paying to prosecute their cases, but there's all kinds of evidence that, in fact, they did pay their attorneys for the services that those attorneys rendered. So sometimes I think these attorneys are taking these cases simply because, you know, they need to keep their firm open and they need every bit of business they can possibly lay hands on. Sometimes I think that these lawyers are taking these cases because they believe that the law ought to provide some kind of protection for those who the court would deem illegally enslaved, right? That there ought to be people who could be legally enslaved, and then there are people who are illegally enslaved. And there ought to be sort of a distinction between those two forms of enslavement. And again, I think that suggests how not radical as a whole these attorneys are. One last thing that I think really distinguishes attorneys in St. Louis is that many of them go on to be extraordinarily prominent in not just Missouri politics, but in some cases, national politics. So you have, for instance, Edward Bates, who becomes Attorney General under Abraham Lincoln. He represents a number of these freedom suit plaintiffs in St. Louis. You have a number of other sort of really centrally sort of important political figures. So these are not sort of fringe characters. They are not, you know, the 19th century equivalents of kind of ambulance chasers. They are, in fact, you know, really well-respected members of the Missouri bar and folks who have an eye on kind of climbing the political ladder.
And I find your attention to the motives of these lawyers to be so interesting in the book, and pointing out that for one thing, most of them are not, as you just said, any sort of radical abolitionist. And even though they're not, they're probably still taking this because they have this belief in the law. The law says that slavery is legal. Some people can be enslaved, but by its very definition, some people shouldn't be enslaved, that there can be illegal slavery, and that by upholding someone's freedom, they are, in essence, also upholding the enslavement of other people.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, I think that you know, there are different ways to sort of interpret the meaning of freedom suits. Obviously, freedom suits provide an avenue to freedom for many enslaved people. But the overwhelming majority of enslaved people in the United States and certainly in Missouri or even in St. Louis, they don't have the grounds upon which they could base a freedom suit. They're not ever going to be able to take advantage of these freedom suit statutes that exist. So in some ways, right, these freedom suit statutes and attorneys' willingness to prosecute freedom suits is a kind of safety valve, if you will. It's a sort of protection for the institution of slavery as a whole by ensuring that there are a very small number of enslaved people who can take advantage of these freedom suit statutes and obtain their freedom. You are, in fact, protecting the legitimacy of the overarching system. That's certainly one interpretation. I think that's probably the interpretation that I find most appealing in terms of sort of trying to understand, you know, how these attorneys thought about what it was they were doing. Many of these attorneys are slaveholders in their own right. So how is it that they come to represent these freedom suit plaintiffs? Who is it that they think these folks are, and why is it that these folks are uniquely deserving of freedom when sometimes their own slaves, you know, certainly haven't been set free, when certainly these attorneys don't seem to have any qualms about the institution sort of as a whole or the institution writ large.
And your other point about how these lawyers are sometimes probably just taking these just to keep their doors open is pretty interesting because of, you know, we're not used to thinking of enslaved people as property holders, as people who have, you know, the amount of money it might take to pay a lawyer to actually prosecute something on their behalf. And yet, as you said, and as you pointed out in the book, you know, these people are actually, you know, actively trying to pay lawyers so that they can get the best representation that they can possibly get.
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, one of the recent sort of revelations, maybe led by Dylan Penningroth's excellent claims of kinfolk, right, is that people who were considered property, in fact, actually were able to own property in their own right, even though by law they shouldn't have been able to, right? But they were able to lay claim to this property and to accumulate money in some cases. We know from not only Dylan's tremendous work, but other folks who've worked on urban slavery that urban slaves often had more access to cash money, and more opportunities to earn the kind of money that that one would need to sort of prosecute one's case. So, you know, that's kind of another example of St. Louis sort of being a perfect storm. There is all this mobility. There are enslaved people who are hired out for long periods of time, and sometimes they don't even see their master for years at a time. They have these opportunities to make money, to prosecute a case. And I think too, thinking about sort of the money end of it from the attorney's perspective, you know, I think we imagine that somebody who would, for instance, go on to be Attorney General of the United States wouldn't need to take on these, what we might otherwise think of kind of like piddling little cases. But, you know, this is a day and age before there is kind of a corporate retainer. There aren't attorneys who, you know, are in big firms that do sort of incredible volume business with a single client. And, you know, they exist on a kind of frontier basis. They need to make their name in a variety of different ways. And they need every single client who walks through the door. So you don't want to turn away an enslaved client who's coming to you to prosecute one of these freedom suits, because it's yet another opportunity to earn a few bucks here and there.
Yeah, I mean, it's all just kind of fascinating the way all of these different worlds converge in this place that is literal convergence of separate different worlds, the American confluence. But you just spoke about people, enslaved people, you know, not seeing their the people who are owning them for so long because they might be out working somewhere. And so in one of your chapters, you kind of focus on this about working for freedom. And what does this mean for you? Because you make the point that in many cases, the history of emancipation and manumission usually looks at like that one act, like once the kind of ink is dried on the paper, the person's free. And that's the kind of moment that matters. But you say that in many cases, people in the American confluence, enslaved people here, are working towards that moment. So what does that look like for you?
Well, I think what I wanted to capture in that particular chapter is the ways in which sort of, you know, actually filing a freedom suit is often the culmination of many, many years, sometimes decades, worth of experience and learning, right? I mean, so often, you know, enslaved people have spent years, again, accumulating money that they might need to prosecute a suit. They've spent years learning about the law and learning about the different bases for freedom suits. They've spent an incredible amount of time trying to figure out, you know, which white people might be able to offer testimony on their behalf to substantiate whatever claim that they might make. They've taken years kind of weighing the different options that are laid out before them. You know, one of the ways in which you might obtain your freedom is by filing a freedom suit. But another way in which you might obtain your freedom is by threatening to file a freedom suit, right? You might use it as a kind of bargaining chip or a kind of bargaining tool. Because once your master knows essentially that you know that you could walk into a circuit court and file a suit, all of a sudden you have more power than you previously had in that relationship. And I think what you see in the particular chapter that talks about working one's freedom is the story of a man named Vincent, who I find absolutely fascinating. He's somebody who spends years being hired out. His master lives in Kentucky, and he himself seems to be from Kentucky. And he's hired out to work at the Salines or Salt Works in southeastern Illinois for a long period of time. And over this period of time that he spends in southeastern Illinois, he increasingly gains more autonomy, more control for himself, such that eventually when his master's sons come to claim him to try to get him to come back to Kentucky, he basically kind of refuses to do it. And he uses all this kind of chicanery to get out of, and he makes promises to them. No, I'll be back in another week or another 2 weeks or a month. He starts running his own business. He starts, you know, creating salt in his own right and selling it, working alongside another seemingly free black man. So it kind of sets up his own business. And then eventually he is transported to St. Louis. And my argument is that, you know, having had the opportunity to gain a bit more control over his own life circumstances, that became more and more kind of intoxicating over time. He got more and more used to sort of asserting himself, especially vis-a-vis his master and his master's sons. His master passes away and the sons proceed to fight over not only Vincent, but a number of other enslaves that they inherited as well. And it's kind of, you know, kind of at this final juncture when Vincent is finally dragged away from the life he's kind of created for himself in southeastern Illinois to St. Louis, where he finally files suit, you know, and like I said, this is the culmination of many, many years of kind of struggle and negotiation. And I think, you know, the St. Louis freedom suit case files really bear out this process for a lot of individuals that there isn't, you know, it isn't as if a flip gets switched. You know, they didn't know that you could file a freedom suit. They learn that you can file a freedom suit, and all of a sudden they file one and they either are successful or are unsuccessful. The end. Instead, what you often see is, you know, long periods of time passing between an enslaved person making their way to St. Louis and actually deciding to file suit. And there is definitely the suggestion in many of these case files that the precipitating factor is the threat to the family life that they've created. The woman who spends the most amount of time in St. Louis with the grounds to sue, who doesn't file suit, she takes many decades before she finally files suit in the St. Louis Circuit Court. Certainly there's the suggestion in her case file that what ultimately pushes her to take this, you know, formal course of legal action is threats to her family. She's had a number of children. She has grandchildren. She is worried about being removed from the city and being removed from her family. And she's worried about her children or her grandchildren being removed from the city, about her family being broken up. And that's, I mean, in her particular case, that's the match that essentially lights this spark that becomes not only her case, but the cases of several of her children. So that too, you know, I think suggests that freedom is this real process, that it isn't something that I think enslaved people come to lightly. The decision to file one of these freedom suits is fraught with all kinds of risk and danger and the possibility of retribution. And so you have to be absolutely sure that you kind of exhausted every other possibility before I think you're kind of willing to take these risks. And I would also suggest that I think that that's really evocative of a worldview that is very foreign from our own worldview, right? I think, you know, today, I think we all like to think that we do anything to protect our freedom. You know, this was a world in which Black people certainly didn't have equality, even if they were free. Almost all Black people worked in decidedly subordinate positions to white people, whether they were enslaved or they were indentured or whether they were free Black people, but they were basically confined to a handful of kind of degraded occupations. This was not a world in which I think Black people had, you know, the kind of expansive horizons that we hope, you know, all Americans, I think, have today. This was instead a world in which I think you could very easily, as an enslaved person, look around and think, well, I've made it to St. Louis and my family is intact in St. Louis, and maybe I get the opportunity to make a little bit of money on the side, and I'm able to purchase some small luxuries for myself and my family. And you think, you know, I have a pretty good thing going here. I'm not going to risk my current situation. I'm not going to attempt to achieve the perfect and forego the good that I really have. It's when the good, I think, is threatened that you often see these enslaved people, you know, willing to put it all on the line and prosecute these freedom suits, but not until then. And I think that tells us something about how different their worldview, their understanding of kind of what their life opportunities were, than the ones that we as sort of modern liberal 21st century beings might imagine or might think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to think of it that way, in that you know, it's something that is not, say, natural to come to in a world where, you know, you're literally enslaved to someone else. You know, as you mentioned just now and in the book, you know, bringing a freedom suit, if you lost, there's the real threat of retribution. Even if you bring the freedom suit and you have a really good case, the people, the person or people who are enslaving you might take extra legal matters to sell you further south, which is for many enslaved people, the ultimate punishment and possibly a death sentence in its own right. And so making these difficult decisions over, as you've pointed out, decades of either building, you know, your own kind of personal wealth or, you know, building the networks that you need, it's something that takes a lot of energy and time. And it's something that you really have to think about, not only for yourself, but for the family, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's been so much great recent work about, the importance of family and familial networks for enslaved people. And I think the St. Louis Freedom Suits really bear that out.
Yeah. And so to kind of go towards what the book, I guess, might be building towards or might not, but, you know, it's in the title, Dred Scott. How does your work help us to understand what might be arguably, you know, the most famous slave case in American history that most people are probably familiar with coming into reading this book?
Well, I think for me, one of the biggest takeaways is that, you know, to read the Dred Scott decision, not that I think many people read it from beginning to end. It's a relatively long decision, and there are many dissents. To read the Dred Scott decision, to read Roger Taney's decision, you would get a very misleading idea about Dred Scott the man. You get a very misleading idea about freedom suits. The suggestion in the Dred Scott decision is Dred Scott is utterly exceptional. There's no one like him. This is the only time we've ever seen a case like this, which, you know, Roger Taney damn well knew wasn't the case, wasn't true. Roger Taney had presided over a couple of other freedom suits that had made their way to the United States Supreme Court. There were a number of state Supreme Courts that handed down decisions in freedom suits, in addition to obviously the Missouri Supreme Court, which I'm most familiar with. But you would certainly get the sense that, as Roger Taney famously proclaims, you know, the black man had no rights that the white man was bound to respect, and as if freedom suits were an impossibility, had never really existed at all. And I think what he's doing there, I mean, in addition to engaging in some really lousy history and intentionally sort of misleading the public, he's speaking with such incredible authority about the topic that I think, if you know, if your first exposure to the Dred Scott case is reading the Dred Scott case, it's not, you know, reading about freedom suits, it's not even necessarily reading about Roger Taney sort of more generally, or it's reading about the reaction to the case, I think if that was where you were to go to, you would think that there simply wasn't any precedent to the Dred Scott case and to the experience that Dred Scott's case speaks to. And in fact, you know, what you find certainly in the St. Louis Freedom Suits is an incredible wealth of these experiences and often extraordinarily similar experiences. And in fact, you know, one of the things that I end up arguing is there's actually nothing at all exceptional about Dred Scott the man in terms of sort of his experience. His experience is replicated hundreds of thousands of times. So it's happenstance that we associate everything with this particular man and this particular suit, given the huge number of cases that actually exist.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to be able to kind of put Dred Scott in perspective, in that, you know, for a lot of reasons, it's only as famous as it is simply because it made it to the Supreme Court and because Roger Taney wanted to make, you know, such a big deal about it and try and use it as the case to end the slavery question. But as you point out, you know, Dred Scott, there's been hundreds, if not thousands, of other Dred Scotts out there before him trying to do exactly what he was doing.
Absolutely. And I will also say that, you know, Dred Scott, when he initially files suit in the St. Louis Circuit Court, because he files suit in the St. Louis Circuit Court first, and that case works its way through the Missouri Supreme Court before he files in federal court. And it's the federal case that ultimately makes its way to the Supreme Court. When he first files suit in the latter half of the 1840s, Dred Scott, the man, should have had every expectation that he was going to win his case based on everything that had happened in Missouri up until that point, based on the precedent that had been handed down by the Missouri Supreme Court and other freedom suits. So, you know, you have to imagine sort of this moment in which Dred Scott approaches an attorney and describes, you know, the facts of his case. And you have to imagine that the legal advice he gets is, oh, you know, this case is going to be essentially a slam dunk. There's no unique information here in your freedom suit that the Missouri Supreme Court hasn't already seen before, that the St. Louis Circuit Court hasn't seen before. And in fact, Dred Scott does win his circuit court case. It's the Missouri Supreme Court that overturns it because the makeup of the Missouri Supreme Court has changed because it no longer has Supreme Court justices who are favorably disposed towards, you know, handing down these kind of emancipatory precedents, or upholding, in this case, emancipatory precedents that the court had decided decades prior. So I think that too, you know, is about recovering kind of the contingency of that moment and thinking about, you know, being Dred Scott and filing this first freedom suit and having, you know, the incredible misfortune of filing at, you know, at this exact moment when the makeup of the Missouri Supreme Court has changed. And then, you know, slightly later, by the time the case makes it to the United States Supreme Court, when the court has, you know, decided that it's going to attempt to settle the slavery question on the backs of a single suit, yours. So I think there's absolutely no reason to believe that Dred Scott's case is going to become what it becomes. And I think that's very different from a lot of other Supreme Court cases. You know, there's a lot of Supreme Court cases that are created because they think that the case will be attractive to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court, it will be irresistible to the Supreme Court. And this is, you know, this is an instance in which I don't think anybody could have predicted that's ultimately where this case would end up. It's not as if it's a brilliantly designed challenge that is laid before Roger Taney for the purpose of him handing down, you know, a tremendously controversial decision.
Yeah. And then as other people's work has shown, you know, Dred Scott itself, even in its time, wasn't exactly adhered to by everyone. It was kind of just ignored outright by some states and everything else. And then, as you mentioned earlier, with some of with Edward Bates, who's representing people on the ground in this area, eventually becomes the attorney general. And then he's asked to, like, give an opinion on Taney's opinion in the court. And so you have this situation where all these people are kind of connected through this interconnected space of the American confluence, and it all kind of comes full circle by the end of the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I think to finish off the interview, could you tell our listeners what might have been, say, your most interesting find with this, since there's so many cases that you had access to? Did you have one or two that were just kind of, like, really stood out to you?
Well, I have to say one of the biggest surprises in working with these cases, and I think the reason that I really fell in love with the cases is because they provide a window onto the experiences of enslaved people and the experiences of slaveholders that, you know, we just don't have enough of for, you know, those of us who work on American slavery and are specifically interested in the enslaved experience. You know, we know that the number of sources we have is incredibly limited. Almost all of those sources are very heavily mediated by white people. There are methodological challenges related to just about every kind of source we can lay our hands on. In a lot of ways, certainly the freedom suits are not an exception here to that general rule, but they do offer an opportunity to hear kind of the life stories of a large number of enslaved people and their relationships to not only their masters, but to other enslaved people, to their families, to white people who may be sympathetic to their cause. It provides that kind of glimpse into their lives that I think is all, unfortunately, all too rare. And I will also say sometimes they're downright comical. They're in the way that you know, truth can be stranger than fiction. Some of the stories that manage to make their way into one of these freedom suits, they have real flesh and blood people doing real things, and sometimes kind of wacky or zany things, very human things. So I think from the standpoint of somebody who's interested in just humanistic study writ large, they can be really fascinating and rewarding to read. And in terms of sort of the my favorite finding, maybe the finding that I came back to again and again, so much so that I ended up opening the book with this particular vignette, was the story of Vincent, a man that I've already spoken a little bit about, and two of the men who had been claiming him, and the kind of bizarre scene that breaks out on the banks of the Mississippi River. So obviously river culture is incredibly important to this book. And what you wind up with is this scene whereby a slaveholder has paddled out into the middle of the Mississippi River because he's convinced that the sheriff is about to show up and take him into custody. And he's convinced that the sheriff is about to take him into custody because, He either hasn't been showing up for proceedings related to a freedom suit that's been filed against him, or he hasn't allowed Vincent to meet with his attorney or to attend court proceedings. And so, you know, he paddles out to the Mississippi thinking that, you know, the Mississippi River lays beyond the jurisdiction of the sheriff of St. Louis County. And it is an absolutely sort of comedic tale that I think gets at the heart of people's idea about the law and how the law worked. And some of those ideas are based very much on the letter of the law, or based on what, you know, I routinely in the book refer to as formal law. And others are based on kind of just these kind of ideas that are developed based on things that they overhear, based on sort of notions that they might have about what is right or wrong, or about how something should or shouldn't work, that they then incorporate into their everyday lives. And they use this sort of knowledge, this sort of information, to sort of structure their behavior. So here's the scene in which, you know, you have this man who's sitting in a canoe in the middle of the Mississippi River, and the sheriff shows up, and then another man appears on the banks of the river, and Vincent is there. Vincent's being guarded by this man with a knife so that he can't escape. And this, it's this weird sort of motley crew that has to sort of work out, you know, how to resolve this very particular situation. And it's, you know, this sheriff's agent who's standing on the banks who has to say, you know, there's no danger in you coming to shore. I'm not going to take you into custody. I'm not going to arrest you. And eventually, this particular slaveholder decides that he's going to paddle on in and everything's going to be okay. I love this story for how human it is. I think how funny it is. You know, slavery obviously is not a topic, where you often get these sort of more lighthearted moments, but I think occasionally you get these glimpses of people in their full richness and their full humanity. And I think that has been for me probably the single most rewarding thing about working with these freedom suits is the very sort of humanness that they attest to.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, I remember reading that and thinking that was oddly funny for something dealing with, you know, a man's enslavement. But just thinking about, you know, someone, we're used to probably thinking about people who enslave others as kind of like all powerful people who have, you know, all this sway over all the people that they enslave. And yet you have someone trying to run away from a sheriff in a paddle boat on the Mississippi. And how can you not just look at that and think, okay, this is somewhat funny for the situation that we're in here?
Well, I think it's absolutely sort of suggestive of I think the power dynamics that exist in this part of the country, where enslaved people like Vincent have attained as much autonomy as they have. They've attained as much knowledge about the law as they have. And they have these freedom suit statutes that they can, you know, manipulate to sort of suit their own ends. And, you know, this is definitely sort of an instance in which you think about a slaveholder and master as holding all the power, or certainly the lion's share of power. And what you really find here is that Vincent has managed to level the playing field to a remarkable degree. He certainly doesn't have the upper hand, but he shows himself to be, you know, incredibly savvy at manipulating his master and his master's sons into essentially doing his own bidding. And I think there's lots of examples or instances of that. And I think that in and of itself, you know, is a reflection of the way slavery works in the American confluence, where you can routinely slip across, you know, to the other side of a river, and you could be on, you know, supposedly free soil in one moment, and an hour later you could be on supposedly slave soil, and no one may be able to pinpoint your actual status for absolute certain. So there's a tremendous amount of sort of confusion, and I think this confusion presents some real opportunities for enslaved people to, you know, sometimes best or get the better of their masters.
Yeah, it's something to say that, you know, Vincent in that scenario is able to sort of flip the power dynamics and have where we're usually thinking or used to thinking of enslaved people as running away, have his one of his slaveholders running away from the law.
Absolutely.
And so I guess one more question. What can our listeners expect from you in the future after they have gone out and read and hopefully buy your book? What can we expect from you in the future? What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm particularly interested in thinking more about the kind of long end of slavery in this purportedly free North. So in some ways it is an extension of the first project. In other ways, it kind of takes on new dimensions. So one of the sites I'm interested in is the Old Northwest, familiar territory, thinking about indentured servitude and its longevity in that particular region, and trying to identify as many indentured people as I possibly can. And then the other site that I'm really fascinated with is sites where these gradual emancipation statutes were adopted. So I'm interested in specifically efforts to circumvent these gradual emancipation laws. I'm curious about how many enslaved people who were entitled to their freedom at some later date as a result of these gradual emancipation statutes, how many of them were actually sold further south in contravention of those laws into a lifetime of slavery. I think that's a problem that historians have long known about, but really haven't attempted to quantify in any real sort of substantive way. So in some ways, kind of a return to sort of familiar ground and getting to play in the same territory and with some of the same records that I looked at the first time. And in another way, really expanding upon the geographical sort of scope of my inquiry by moving into the Eastern Seaboard, moving into New Jersey and Pennsylvania and New York in particular, where these gradual emancipation statutes were so important.
Well, that certainly sounds very interesting. Hopefully once that's out, we can have you back on the program and talk about that book.
Well, I'd love to.
Well, thank you for having us or for letting us have you on the program. Again, everyone, this is Dr. Ann Twitty, author of Before Dred Scott, Slavery and Legal Culture in the American Confluence, 1787 to 1857. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much.